interview with Brian Turner. Brian's a poet. I actually went to one of his readings about a month or two ago and was really moved by what he shared, and asked him to come on and talk a little bit more. So, Brian, thanks for taking the time to chat today.
Oh, I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. So tell us a little bit about yourself. You know, how did you come to writing poetry, and what's your background?
Yeah, I'm a Californian. I originally come from the San Joaquin Valley. I live in Orlando, Florida now, but as a boy, storytelling was really important to me, and I loved history, and I think when I was seven, I wanted to be an historian. So I've shifted from that quite a bit, but there's an element of story and history in pretty much all that I write. I ended up in my teens, my hair got pretty long, played bass guitar in a band, and started taking some poetry classes, hoping it might help me to write better lyrics for the band. And that never really quite worked out, but it did veer me off into this love of poetry that I didn't realize was there. And that I ended up going to the University of Oregon to get an MFA. And it's just been a through line throughout my life, is trying to find a way to use some type of form and language in a form that can house memory.
Yeah, definitely. And it's interesting you mention a history background. I didn't know that. And I have a similar background. I studied history and political science in college, and really think that it's kind of shaped, just the process of thinking, seeing how things connect to each other is really helpful.
Yeah. Sometimes, I don't know if you've done this, where you're driving on a road and there's a hill up ahead where the road has been carved through it. So when you drive through what was the hill, if you look to your left or right, you can see the different striations, the layers of history there, that deep history. Mm. And it's almost like a chord of music. You can see all of time in one instant, And that's something that I don't know, it just kind of goes with everything. Like, I'll see a moment in a story, but then I wonder the deep history that the story arrives from,
Yeah, and there's so much more that can be extracted from every particular moment. And that's when we were at your reading, that's really what struck me, is like the power of what you write in terms of being able to look at like one particular thing, but then there's so much complexity around everything in that moment.
I appreciate that. Yeah, that's I struggle with, I don't know how it is for you. I don't think you struggle with the problem I have, which is, all through childhood, I had a large, and into my 20s, I had a very pronounced stammer. And it made me in some ways almost silent oftentimes. And so I was a listener. And then basically what I had was, I had like kind of like a freight train of language trying to get through my head, but I couldn't sort of take the sentence and land it, Mm-hmm. And I think, a lot of things helped me sort of find my way through that. But through that, I had a great love of language itself, and I was listening, and I think one of the things, a little bit like my mother, I'm very tangential. So that if there's one thing that I'm interested in, I'm trying to tell a story, it's almost like there's too much context, because you have to build a whole world around a simple idea, which is the opposite of what poetry often does in the contemporary sense. So poems have helped me to distill that huge context into a space that, that doesn't negate the context, but I think the context in a lot of poems is in the unsaid or the silence. There's a space for the reader to participate in the construction of meaning, and if we're lucky, sometimes we can gesture to those unsaid things.
Yeah, I think with anything in terms of artwork, whether it's poetry or viewing art, like I do a lot of painting, I think there are three people in the relationship. There's the piece itself, there's the creator, and then the person that's either viewing or listening to it. And it means different things to each of those people or things.
Yeah, and I wonder, do you find when you go back and look at earlier paintings, because now you're a different version of you, so it's almost like different yous as well, right? you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes it's a matter of trying to reconstruct what that feeling was. Like, I can have a vague memory of what it was, but then it's like, you know, can I get back into that feeling and that detail? And other ones, you know, they take you back immediately, you know, and there's something about the power of a particular piece that just takes you right there.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I have that similar experiences in my own work too. Yeah. And I've done some collaborations with other writers where we've written poems and then, you know, that usually it's by email and it takes several months or maybe even a year or so, because we just every now and then send a few lines back and forth and build a poem. And by the time it's finished, it's been a remarkable thing almost with every, you know, duo or pairing that I've done this with. Both of us seem to feel like you can almost lose sense, like we don't know which words are our own. The poems almost becomes its own thing separate from both of us.
Yep.
Yeah.
So one of the things that you shared at the reading was your time of service in the army and the military, and kind of how that had an impact. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. A quick timeline there is, you know, after I studied poetry at the University of Oregon, then I lived in South Korea for a year teaching English, and then I came back and I joined the army late. You know, I was older when I joined, and I was in for a little over 7 years. I was in Fort Drum with the 10th Mountain Division, and I went to Bosnia as a NATO peacekeeper for about just a little under 7 months, from 99 to 2000. And then I went to Fort Lewis in near Tacoma, Washington. And with that unit, we were deployed to Iraq. The 3rd of December, 2003, we crossed the border into Iraq. And I was there for just under a year with the 2nd Infantry Division. And so, and that was more of a combat tour. I don't like the word tour, combat deployment. But in both cases, I was writing poetry when I went to Bosnia. I prior to going there, I was really fascinated. I knew we were going, so I was reading books about it, and I was, you know, trying to learn the history. And then when I was there, I was, you know, meeting people and asking them about their history and their lives. And so I ended up writing a manuscript of poems that hasn't been published, which is fine. But I was learning how to be away from home and fairly austere conditions and write poetry and make a book and be in conversation with the space and that kind of thing. So I think a lot of writing that book there helped me when I went to Iraq, where I didn't often have as much resource to, or time to sit down and write poems the way I did in Bosnia. But I did end up writing my first published book of poems. It's called Here Bullet, in my notebooks when I was in Iraq. And then when I came home, I typed them up over the course of a month or so and then sent them out to a contest, and it was taken by Alice James Books, who's still continues to be my publisher. And it's been an amazing experience. It's almost 20 years now, and those poems have a life of their own that live beyond me, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Going back to kind of the study of history, there's some ways words like that in an environment like that are kind of eternal, right? I mean, in some ways, wars are always the same, and you know, you go through the same experiences.
Yeah, and it might feel a little mystical. I don't know how you feel about this, but some of the poems feel not just those poems, but when I write, sometimes it feels very overt. Like I can see an idea and I begin to chip away at it, like looking at a block of stone and being able to see into the marble what might be in there. But other times, and I think these are the ones that feel like gifts, a poem will feel like a breeze blowing through the imagination. They arrive from somewhere else, and then they continue on beyond me. And if I'm lucky, I can kind of catch the whispers on the wind and write down the words, and that's the poem, you know.
I mean,
that's mystical, but, you know, the imagination, the subconscious, a lot of it seems to arrive from another place, you know.
No, it's so true. And the fact is, the you know, those mists that kind of go by, you know, you can't recapture them. You know, it's like you have you have maybe a minute or less, depending on your attention span, to try to get down as many reminders of what you're thinking so then you can go back and reconstruct it. But yeah, I know exactly what you mean. I've had that experience plenty. I'm sure a lot of people have.
I sometimes I think it's a meditative practice oftentimes, or really, it's a kind of a lifelong thing. And I think of it as like sitting, I'm up here right now at Lake Tahoe, and I imagine in the writing process sometimes, or the creative process sometimes, is like being able to still the self as if sitting on the shore of the lake when it's very calm. And every now and then something will come up from beneath the surface and arrive. But usually it sort of burbles up and has seaweed on it, and you can't know what it is. And then like when you wake up from a dream and in the morning, and you remember the dream, but then it right as you're trying to remember it, it just kind of sinks back under, and you can't remember. In a similar way, this idea might go back into the lake and it's gone. But every now and then, something will arrive fully formed, and you can kind of put it down to the page, or I guess in your case, paint, And I also make music, so it's a similar way there. But I'm not very proficient on any particular instrument, so that is much more overtly done. It doesn't feel like it always arrives from somewhere else,
Are you still in a band?
A couple bands actually, but the main one is
Nice.
the Retro Legion. That's the but there's a band, there's a project that's I'm really excited about that'll come out in the next year or two. We're called Heavy Everything, and we're working on a pretty hard rock album. So I'm hoping people, I wanted to make something that you could crank up while driving down the highway and just really enjoy seeing the country as the wind blowing in your hair, that kind of music.
Nice. So, not to deny listeners, but the ability to kind of appreciate your work. Do you have a poem or two you would want to kind of read to share?
Yeah, absolutely. Do you want to hear some from this time as a serviceman, or
Whatever you choose.
maybe I'll read one from before and one from currently, kind of
Okay.
thing. Do that. I'll read the title poem from Here Bullet. Now I think I'll read the last poem, one of the last poems in the book. So this is something I wrote. It's the last poem I wrote while I was in Iraq, before while I was waiting for the plane that would take us home. But I'm writing it as if I'm already on the plane looking back. It's called Night in Blue. At 7,000 feet and looking back, running lights blacked out under the wings, and America waiting. The year of my life disappears at midnight. The sky a deep viridian. The house lights below, small as match heads, burned down to embers. Has this year made me a better lover? Will I understand something of hardship, of loss? Will a lover's senses in my kiss or touch? What do I know of redemption or sacrifice? What will I have to say of the dead, that it was worth it, that any of it made sense? I have no words to speak of war. I never dug the graves in Tel Afar. I never held a mother crying in Ramadi. I never lifted my friend's body when they carried him home. I have only the shadows under the leaves to take with me, the quiet of the desert, the low fog of Balad, orange groves with ice forming on the rinds of fruit. I have a woman crying in my ear late at night when the stars go dim. Moonlight and sand as a resonance of the dust of bones, and nothing more. So that's in my first book, Here Bullet. And that's when I came back home from Iraq. I had about a month where everybody else went on block leave, and a few of us stayed back. And I just typed up the poems from those notebooks that I'd been scrawling with things. They were mostly, memoir-like, diary kind of things, but among them were poems. And enough to make that book. The book has about two or three poems that I wrote that month when I came back home, but all of it's from that time, so it's not heavily edited. It's one of the things I like about that book is that it's kind of raw. I could have made it more polished, I'm sure, but there's a kind of rough quality to them that I think makes sense in a lot of
Yeah,
ways.
definitely. So how do you think the war changed you from a before and after kind of?
I think it may be, I guess there's so many ways to talk about that. One is It made me realize that I was not right now. If I think, how is it changing me right now? I think right now I wish I were more of a global citizen. I wish that I had better friendships across the globe and not just in a national sense in America, you know? And so like I've created some friendships, and I've been a partner to creating friendships over the years with writers in Iraq, for example. But I don't think I've been, from looking back, I don't think I've been anywhere near, I should have been, I wish I'd been more attentive to those and developed them further even. I don't think I've been a good enough friend to people in Iraq, for example. But, I hope part of my work now is, I learned this a bit from around 2008 or so, Kevin Bowen and others brought me to the William Joyner Center in at UMass Boston. It's changed dramatically since then, but back in the day, it was very much an amazing community that they were all Vietnam vets who had started going back to Vietnam and meeting their counterparts as artists. They're all writers, and Kevin's a painter also, but they would go back and forth, and they've done it to this day, and creating lifelong friendships in art with people they used to fight against, and and so that model is something that I wish I had spent some time and figured out a way, and maybe it'll still happen, or maybe somebody out there listening, maybe this sparks a necessary fire to create some type of conversation like that with our brothers and sisters around the globe who are maybe we've been in conflict with them or not, but to have a wider vision, I think, because we can learn a lot. We can learn a lot from each other here in America, but there's a poetic practices, for example, across the globe, and there are different ways of approaching the same fundamental themes of the deep and messy human stuff that we all dip our pens in that reservoir and write from, you know.
Yeah, and I mean, there's so many global conflicts today that, I mean,
Yeah.
clearly it's something we all need to be more invested in.
Yeah. And sometimes, nations, they find some way to get in conflict as a whole, but I think sometimes it takes individual people to start learning how to speak with each other, and then the nation maybe will catch up. Yeah. Like, how can we fall in love with another country? For example, I was really lucky to be a part of the U.S.-Japan Friendship Fellowship Commission, which I'd never heard of before, but they had this amazing thing since World War II. They've brought it's a partnership between the NEA and a similar organization in Japan. I believe it's called the Bunkacho, and but those two organizations partner to bring artists from America each year in all across dis artistic disciplines, from composers to dancers to writers to et cetera. And they bring them to Japan for about 3 months at a time. And I got to do that in 2012 with my wife. And then the essence of it is that we'll kind of fall in love and create friendships there. And then we'll bring back our experiences of Japanese culture to create a bridge, between.
It's interesting. I grew up in Baltimore, and hearing you talk about this particular thing with Japan makes me think, growing up, it's like you study history of World War II and the war with Japan and December 7th, and there's a lot of baggage that can be passed on through history books. But then I also remember growing up there in the 80s, there was also a program called Sister City. And I remember that the sister city for Baltimore was a city in Japan. I think it was Kyoto. And that I remember that really softened my perspective of Japan. Right. It's like on the one hand, I'm being indoctrinated with one set of facts, but on the other, just as a Joe Q student, I'm seeing, hey, this is completely different than, the way that it was. It doesn't necessarily have to always be that way.
Yeah. And you know, I was lucky enough that we based ourselves in Kyoto and the ancient capital, and what a beautiful city. And we had we got a couple we rented a couple little bicycles, and we just motored around town on those all the time, and it was beautiful. It's a good time. Yeah, a lot of amazing art going on there too. And that's the thing, like if I guess for example, it's not I don't think it's possible in Afghanistan right now, but in Iraq there, we may not be able to travel there. And so I went there back there with National Geographic in 2011, I believe, and did a story about it. But you may or may not feel comfortable going there, but with Zoom we and other means, we can now be in contact and as artists collaborate and do things like that. So I did I was with Sholeh Wolpe and Sadek Muhammad and Mujib Mirdad. Mujib is from Kabul. He's now in the States. And Sadek is a poet in Baghdad. But the four of us, Sholeh is a Iranian American poet in Los Angeles and also, I believe, in Barcelona. But the four of us work partner together to make a book together. I really like collaborative projects like that too, because writing can be such a seem like such a solitary art, and it often is, right? But like my name on the I have three new books, and these books have my name on the cover. But with these three books, there's about 300 or plus people. I've tried to count it, but it's a little over 300 who helped me in one way or another to make this book, these books happen. There's so many hands in the making.
That's amazing. So, do you have another piece?
Sure. Let's do here. Kind of debating whether it should be a sad poem, a sexy poem. I don't know. I think I'll do a sort of sexy poem. We'll see. Of course, I'm not very good at that whole part, but we'll see. It's called coconut oil. And I guess for those who don't know, I mean, we've talked about my military experience, but and I've talked about my wife and going to Kyoto and all. She's an amazing poet, Elise Kuznets. She passed away in 2016. I don't even like saying the word passed away, crossed over. Just like the language fails me, but that's partly why I turned to poems to write. And this one is called Coconut Oil. I don't recall the PA's name, but she recommended coconut oil as a lubricant, saying, "Sure, the literature leans towards water-based lubes, but you can find this anywhere. Any grocery will carry it, and it's a natural moisturizer, easy enough to clean from the sheets." And so when I discover a jar in the house years later, I unscrew the metal lid, close my eyes, and breathe in a series of moments from a springtime made of fog and confusion, sunlight and surprise, chemo treatments, a trip to Hawaii, the breakers rolling in just outside our bedroom window, the night's perfume carrying over the Pacific and reminding us of our time in Japan, Thailand before that, before the cancer, when the future lay wide open. Elise cupped my hips with the soft pads of her hands, using them as a brake at the iliac crest, while coconut sugared the room with its fragrance. She eased me down inside of her, pressing back when the raw pain furrowed across her brow, crimped her mouth, her palm heels nearly pushing me out as I couldn't help but think of the tumors in her bones, spreading from sternum to vertebrae and then scaling the ladder of the spine in both directions, so insidious, so cruel, that cancer revealing itself by fracturing two of the bones in the middle of her back a couple of years before, and how, afterward, I thought of my fault. That I'd done this somehow without realizing the danger inside of her. On a sunlit afternoon, shared in a tangle of salt and muscle, our limbs half on, half off the bed, the mattress stripped of its sheets, and Elise spurring me harder, harder, so that even now I remember it at the snap of a finger, and that familiar regret returns and lingers. And so I close my eyes and breathe in coconut until the electricity shifts its current. Blue and crackling, the calendar flipping through months, seasons of our maroon sheets sliding off the bed, the candle's bright tongue rising in light as she guides me down, slow, all of it so tenuous and fragile, on the cusp of pain, until the oils begin to soften and glide, and her body easing now, gives way to the smooth motion of flesh, the two of us made one again, made strange and new and ancient and beautiful.
Oh my God, dude.
Thanks, man.
That is beautiful. It's a combination of, as a listener / reader, I'm sitting here with a smile on my face at just being able to imagine what the experience is, but then tears, you know, from like the losing of it, you know, and the recollection.
Yeah.
That's so moving.
Yeah, she's a beautiful soul and an amazing poet. She her first collection is called Small Hours, and it was with the Truman State University Press, a beautiful book. And then she was writing, in her last couple of years, she was writing the poems that became a posthumous book. She knew she was writing the book, but she had to write the poems fast, and she could, like, we didn't have a chance to talk about, like, what order she wanted the poems in. So that was left to me to figure out how she might order them, you know? Uh-huh. And she was writing them up until the last week or so of her life. And so that book's called Angel Bones. And that they're both with Alice James Books now. So if people are interested, they can check out. No, what they'll discover is a really fine poet and a brilliant mind. But I was lucky enough to be a part of her life. So, yeah.
And she was a scientist too, so her scientific bent really changed how you perceive things too, right?
Yeah, she started as a biology major in college, and that was her first love. And then she sort of shifted track into English and went into writing and got a PhD in post-colonial women's feminist literature. Just a brilliant, brilliant soul. And yeah, so she taught me a lot in so many different ways. I really love, and one of the things I already had in me, but it was just so crystal clear with her, is her precision with language and her love of each individual word and having the right word and just the, you know, the apt choice of words. It's just and also she used to do this beautiful thing where if you were talking with her, her hands were very much in conversation with her language. So when she was talking about stories, you could see her shaping whatever animal or whatever it might be in her hands, like in the air. So it was like she was conjuring the world in the air between us whenever she would talk with someone. Yeah.
Wow. Wow. So do you kind of go through life feeling like she's still here with you?
Yeah, I think, I know that she wanted me to carry her with me, and she wanted me to carry her on, and it's an honor to do so. It's also just, I don't know if I can say this on a pod, but it's shitty, you know, it feels wrong in so many ways. Like, I feel like, you know, I'm given this gift of time, but it would have been so much better served if we'd been the opposite and she had this time and she could write more books. I've been given a lot of oxygen and time in the creative light, and I wish people had more of her. But I do. I do. That's why I struggle with the language, because on a deeper level with your question is just, you know, like, I don't think we don't have a verb tense that matches like how the dead are alive with us.
Yes.
Like, they
yes.
just use the word are, but you know what I mean? Like, we always put them in the past tense, and
yep.
And it doesn't feel right to me, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm a big fan of Ram Dass. And, you know, one of the things that I took away from my experiences with him is that, you know, people who pass away are never gone. They're always here with you. You know, it's just they're in a different form. Yeah. And, you know, incarnations are coming and going. And, you know, it's a blessing to be able to have somebody that you connect to like that in your life, or even if it's just for a short period of time, but you know.
And I think she would have probably thought along the lines of she would have really enjoyed what you just said, and also she would have talked about the landscape of time, You know, sometimes it feels the landscape at the time, where in a lot of contemporary Western thought seems to be as if a kind of past tense place. Like it's a history, right? Like we're at the top of that hill where the grass is still growing, but then the sheared away mountain, it seems a Western thought, everything's this dead layer of stone that we can see and read history and looking down. Like she thinks it more as a landscape of time, as a continual living presence where the past is still alive, but it's in another space where from where we are now.
Yeah. Yeah. And you said it, it's, that's a Western view versus like an Eastern view of reality. Right.
Yeah. So, but yeah. So I often go places and they'll, you know, like, well, I don't want to get too far into it. I like some privacy to my life, but you know, like there was a place we used to go to once, for example, on the coast, and there was a little place we liked to go to that was right on the beach. And I went there a couple of times after she was, and I was just me by myself then. And they would often at this place, they give you two, there's a little, they'll give you a couple of cookies, one for each of you, right, when you check in at this hotel. And I'd still take the cookies, and when I'm talking with them, I would just talk in the present as if she was with me, you know. And I could see the confusion on some of the, or curiosity, wondering if she was going to walk in or something, you know. And it's like a lie to the people around me, but it feels more true than if I, to me, it'd feel like a lie to say the opposite and say no way.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Yeah. So.
No, I applaud that. And I think, you know, I think if we went through life with that kind of perspective in our lives, I think the world would be a better place, you know?
Yeah. I guess those who go on before us, they could be, I like the fact that they can be more in our lives. My mom just passed away in October, and it was hard, but you know, and I was in Northern New Mexico, and I had this, I don't really care about cars, but I'd rented a car at the airport, and they bumped me up to this Ford Mustang convertible, and she would have loved that car. So, you know, she loved cars and motorcycles and stuff like that. And me, I'm just like, if it gets me from A to Z, fine. I don't care what it is, you know. But she would have loved it. And so I put the top down. And I had her ashes in the passenger seat. And I cranked up the Beatles on the stereo, which she loved. And it was morning, and I just sort of drove into the sun for about an hour and a half, because it was the towns there are so far apart where you have to get things done and all. But as I was driving, I realized that oftentimes when grief comes and loss comes, that I like maybe many people go into this low swale, this deep trough of emotion and depression and grief. And I've done that a lot over the last decade. And I realized with my mom, I wish she'd had more years. She was only 75 and I was young. She was in good physical, you know, health, but she'd had dementia. And I just, I realized I want to celebrate her rather than go into the space. And though it was a short life and difficult at the end, she lived a beautiful life. She was a wonderful human being. And I'll share one story because I think it might be useful for listeners, maybe, though I'm not sure how this connects to poetry exactly. But when I was 9 years old, she took me out of school, which was very unusual for her. It was against her nature. She said, "You told me I wasn't going to school that day and was going to write a note for me the next day." And she wasn't going to go to work. And same thing, I guess. And she created what was called Fun Day. And it was March 24th when I was 9 years old. And from that day on until now, and I'll continue it, but March 24th is Fun Day. And I love the idea that she created this own holiday for us. And I really want to share that with others, that they might, like Linda Turner, maybe follow in that tradition and create a personal, a sacred day for those you love around you. Because we inherit cultural rituals and days that are larger scale, usually, you know. Even when it's to the individual birthday, it's that one day. But this is a shared day, but it's not the larger, it's your internal mini tribe, you know?
Yeah. And it's created. It could be anything, you know, and you could do anything, you know. It doesn't have any limitations.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
We would even celebrate when we were apart. We just knew it was our fun day, you know. So, yeah.
No, that's beautiful. You know, one of the, you mentioned the three books that you'd recently written, and I'd read one of the three so far, The Wild Delight of the Wild Things.
Yeah.
And there was a part that I wanted to ask you about. The poem was The Jurassic Coast.
Yeah.
And in it, it's I'm just going to read a little bit. The world that once was, how do we mourn such a loss? How do we comprehend the vanishing of life on a global scale? The dying is so quiet. We have to list lean in and listen just to notice it's even happening. And that section really kind of struck me, because, in my daily life, I deal with climate change issues. And so you look around and you see what's going on. And, like you say, you have to lean in just to be able to be aware of the changes happening, but yet the change is obvious. How do you deal with climate change or issues around that or in your poetry or in your life? Like, what's your take on it as an artist?
Yeah, I think part of the I'm working on some essays now. They're short lyric essays, and they're really connected to, I mean, from A to Z, things that I'm just interested in. And I think of nature as pretty much everything. So it's the big umbrella, the cosmos and things out far. And also most of the pieces I'm writing on are about things like, bacteria and creatures that live in our faces, like mites, things like that. And I guess in a way, there's twofold. One, for me personally, writing about them, it's a way to learn in a deeper way the life that I'm living, learn more about what I think I already know something about. And because you just keep, if you keep picking up the rock, you just keep finding more under it, kind of thing. So for me, that's why I first write them. But the reason for sharing them is that I'm hoping, in a way, like me, what I've been finding is that the more attention I pay to the world around me, the more I feel like I'm falling in love with it. And it's been a healthy process for me since at least, in 2016, because I was pretty angry. It was part of the grief was being very angry that she wasn't here in the way she was before, and that so much was taken from her in a lot of ways with that, and from us, like the book she would have written, et cetera, et cetera. And a lot of just purely selfish things for myself. I just wanted her in a lot larger way. But I started writing and thinking about nature and connecting with nature. And it's just, I think there's a kind of medicine in the process for me personally. So when I share these, I'm hoping maybe if we love the world more, maybe myself included, we'll maybe be better stewards of it, or we'll try to figure out ways to work with each other to take care of this place, as much as we can, and to value and to honor it, I guess that's where I'm coming for with the writing and all. But yeah, like I was in Kolkata, and I went with Sonat Mandal, a poet there, and we went down to we took a bus, and then we got and there was this very small boat, and then a few of us went out on this boat along the in the Sundarbans, this natural preserve where the Nile sort of delta region is, and also the Bangladesh, all that's that watershed area where all that water sort of sieves out, and the back and forth between the ocean and the fresh water coming out from all the way from the Himalayas and all that, and in that there's mangroves and stuff out there. And I was looking at some reports that estimate by 2050 the level of the water. Now, so we're on this boat and we're going through these mangroves. And so I'm talking with like there's a park ranger on our boat because you to go through this area you have to hire a park ranger to be on your boat with you, and he was really interesting. We were talking about tiger attacks and things like that, and local life there, and I was talking with him about the estimates of I think it's like 15 feet of sea level rise, which would put the water at low tide above the present day mangroves. You can see it be above our heads. And I said that, and I remember him shaking his head, no, my father and my grandfather, it's always like this. It's, so it's like, and I think you could just, you could do the same thing most places around the world and around America or wherever, anywhere. And it's hard to see, this local, weather compared to climate, and that it's just hard for the brain to, my own included, to grasp the change, this period of change that we're a part of, that we're in, And
I mean, we're living through literally on the coming of a new age.
At least there's so much infighting here in America, but at least now it feels like, well, I don't know if that's true, but well, it does feel like less people are saying that climate change is not real, so that's, but it's like too late for that. It feels like we need to be much further along in our thinking. It's like we're in it, like we need to already be thinking much further ahead,
I agree. I agree. I agree. Well, I appreciate your taking the time to chat today. I'll definitely put the links for the books in the when I post the recording so people can click onto those to read more. If people want to reach out to you directly, how can they best reach you?
Oh, and another thing, I can also send you the links. They can go on Spotify and they can listen to the Retro Legion because each of the books has an album of music inside of it.
Oh, cool.
And
Awesome.
those are all on the Spotify and all the streaming platforms and all that, except for The Wild Delight of Wild Things, which is internal. That music, there's a QR code inside the book.
Okay.
And then on the back of each book, there's a QR code. There's a three-part video monologue. It's like a film. So it's this weird multimodal project. So there are Easter eggs here if you want to look for them, kind of thing. But if they want
That's
to
fun.
contact me, I can give you can put it down. But I've got an Instagram address at Turner's with an S, Turner's underscore lens, like a camera lens. And they can, add me as a friend and send me a message,
Awesome.
Or if it's something more involved, they can always send through the publisher.
And if you could, I'd love to post the links to your wife's books as well.
Oh, please. Thank you.
Send me those links.
And I've got a, website where I share part of the website with her stuff too there. So,
Very cool.
thank you so much. What a great conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you. And if you don't mind, I mean, I'd love to do it again in the future sometime.
Oh, that'd be great. Yeah, man.
Awesome.
I got to learn more about, I want to go more into your science background and the work you do too. So,
I appreciate it.
be ready.
Sounds good. I'll talk to you soon. Thanks a
Thanks,
lot.
man. Take
Take
care.
care, Brian.